State officer in need.
What's up, guys? It's Matt from the 1078 Project. Hey, if new to the organization, a little bit about us. The 1078 Project is a nonprofit organization that's been founded and developed by law enforcement officers who've been involved in critical incidents and officer-involved shootings. Our goal at the 1078 Project is to provide mental, spiritual, and practical support to law enforcement officers as they navigate the difficult times surrounding an officer-involved shooting. With that being said, let's dive into today's episode, and I'll see you on the other side, boys. What's up, guys? Welcome back to the 1078 Project podcast. Today's guest is one of my best friends. He's a police officer, former soldier, deployed several times, recently retired from the Army Reserves. He is a team leader on the SWAT team. He's been a SWAT operator for an extraordinary amount of time. He was a canine handler for a short period of time and was the victim of a house fire. He's one of my best friends, been a giant mentor in my life, has guided me both professionally, spiritually, and as a dad and a husband. I'm excited for you guys to get to know him. Today's guest is Montana Stevenson. That's such an interesting perspective that your dad said that it's like trying to forget about those things. I've been trying to forget about those things for 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I've always wondered for a guy like that, or even, it doesn't even have to be even that far removed, even the guys from, Iraq and Afghanistan, or it's like, I was talking to Greg Beninati. I don't know if we talked about this on the podcast or if it was off camera. I can't remember, but it was like, because I feel like sometimes like guys like, he's experienced some things and he's lost some friends, and sometimes it kind of seems like they take that same route. Like, I don't want to talk about this. Like, mm-hmm. The best way for me to deal with it is just to bury it and mm-hmm. like let it not become part of who I am.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, man. I just feel like the best way to deal with it is to like embrace it. You know what I mean? Like, this is who you are, and this does define a portion of who you are. It's not who you are wholly yeah. and fully, yeah. but it's definitely a portion of who you are.
Yeah.
And like to bury it, it's like it does him such an injustice. Like, he sacrificed so much for me and you and
yeah.
everyone else.
Absolutely.
And like, to me, it's like, man, we should be grateful for that, number one. And number two, he should embrace that part of him. You right. know what I mean? Like, and it's sad to hear, like, he sacrificed so much, and now he's like, for the last 50 years, he's tried to just bury it inside of himself. And,
yeah.
That's just yeah. such a, especially that generation, man. We just did such a terrible service to those guys. Mm-hmm. Like, the way they were treated after coming back, and like, I can understand why you try and bury it and why yeah. you go get a farm and try and just live a life like that.
Like solitude.
Yeah, like away yeah. from everything. And
yeah.
But man, it's sad that he has that interpretation. Like,
my brother's named after one of his buddies in Vietnam. It's like every day, inadvertently, he probably thought about it, about all the stuff he saw, and I'm sure I know about 10% of it,
Yeah.
But I think, knowing my dad, he probably thinks that he hasn't lived up to the aura that is him. And I wish he would just, I know he does, but it's a hard thing for him to take compliments, I think. And that's me too. Like, I don't like compliments yeah. in a way because
yeah.
it just makes you feel weird.
Yeah.
I'm sure he'll listen to this and probably, like, no, I'm not that cool, but he is.
Yeah. yeah. Like the beginning of Delta Forces. Like,
you're at yeah, the very beginning. Legit.
That's sick.
Yeah, if you talk, like hearing Tim Kennedy talk about Mack V. Sog or Jocko, he's actually had my dad's interpreter.
Really?
On there. I haven't listened to that one yet, but I found out about that. So that dude, that interpreter, he's seen some stuff because he never left,
Really?
People would come and go like every 6 months. That's a tour back then. That dude never left. He was there for years and survived.
Really?
Yeah. So anywho,
that's crazy.
Yeah.
It just like breaks my heart that he'd feel like that animosity towards himself for everything that he sacrificed for
all of us, you know? And that seems to be a really common reaction.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it seems to be a really, really common reaction is like, bury it. Don't talk about it. Like, it's almost like a past life.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And like, I don't know. It just breaks my heart to see guys suffer like that, you know? Yeah. 50 years trying to bury
it. And he's such a, oh, crap. I didn't strip my watch off. Yeah. Oh, what was I saying?
You said he's such a something.
Oh, he's just such a humble guy. Like, it's almost like, I remember sitting up in church one time and talking about a missionary, and Vietnam came up. And I say I've only seen him cry twice, but I mean, I remember seeing him moved.
Really?
You know, just by talking about that.
Is that what drew you towards the military?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. You say you don't have any regrets or anything like that. And I have no issues with the way my life ended up. Mm-hmm. But it's like probably my only regret is not doing something else in the military. I can go into that side of it real fast. My freshman year of college, so I went to school up near, I followed my wife to the Quad Cities, and I went to a college up there called Blackhawk College, and I got a vocal music scholarship, and after that year, I knew that I wanted to join the military, kind of follow off my dad's footsteps, but yet use that as an experience, a gateway or bridge to police work. So I was like, oh, what better than military police? I'm thankful for my service. I did 22 years in the reserves, retired as a master sergeant. So I'm not saying like wasn't successful or anything like that. But so I joined a month after September 11th. And
how was that? How was knowing that you want to join the military, watching 9/11 happen? I'm guessing you were going to join before 9/11.
Yeah, that was the plan.
Did that just speed the process up, or
probably? Yeah, I remember watching the Twin Towers fall from my apartment in Moline, Illinois. And then that night, gas went up to $1.99, which is gouging. I would
wish that you had
$1.99. Yeah. So then. I remember talking to Kristen about it, and then October 12th, 2001, I went to the recruiter and signed up.
What'd Kristen say?
Oh, she's always been supportive, no matter anything I've ever done, she's been supportive. And so I did a delayed entry program. That happened, and the unit that I signed up into, the reserve unit, got deployed to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And they were one of the first units to get deployed after the invasion of Afghanistan. I believe it was December is when they got called up. So I was home on Christmas break from school. And the thing you got to remember about pre-war Army, reserves especially, like their records and the efficiency was just not there, like the training aspect and everything like that. It was a pre-war atmosphere. Like,
yeah.
We hadn't experienced anything major. Obviously, we had Desert Storm, stuff like that, but that lasted 100 hours. So we hadn't anything major in a long time, like I guess since Vietnam. So they saw my name on the record books, you know, on the roster, and I didn't report. I hadn't even been to basic yet.
No way.
And so it was really weird because I came back and my neighbor and the apartment manager both confirmed, like, hey, the cops were inside your apartment looking for you. I said, come again? I said, yeah, there's cops inside your apartment looking for you. So I later found out one of the platoon leaders was a police officer. And
he went inside your
house. He went inside my freaking apartment. That was before I knew anything about the Constitution. Yeah. they thought I was like absconding. They thought I was a AWOL. Turns out I wasn't on any like active roster. I was like on the roster that he had or somebody had. And then they found out like I can't find like. And then they found out, hey, he hasn't been to basic yet. Like,
no way.
We need to stop looking for him. So that was pretty funny. I found that out. So then I went to basic in July 2nd, 2002.
What was that like?
I went to Fort Leonard Wood. Basic training was, I wish I would have been a little bit more physically prepared for it. Like, it wasn't crazy hard, but it was funny. I learned a lot about heart rate training and everything like that. I always qualified that you ran in like Alpha Bravo Charlie group, right? Alpha group was the fastest, Bravo Charlie. So now I have a very good understanding and the physical aspect of your body and training. But back then I was always, they used my time as the cutoff for Alpha. So every time we did ability group runs or things like that, my heart rate would be over 200. Like, I would be trying as hard as I could to keep up with the group because everybody else was way faster than me. I should have been in a Bravo group. And so then throughout basic training, everybody in Bravo, like half of Bravo started passing me because they were training at the appropriate level of intensity.
Yeah.
Me, I was at 100%.
Were they monitoring your heart rate?
No. I'm just throwing a number out there.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, so that was a side note that nobody cares about.
We care.
Yeah, okay, yeah. But funny story from basic. As you know, jovial people in basic training is not a good combination, right? I remember one particular time where I got smoked out my mind, me individually. And if anybody listening to this has been in the military, you know that individual smokings, you have to do something stupid for an individual smoking because normally it's like everybody.
Yeah.
And if when I say smoking, they didn't actually make me smoke any type of substance.
Yeah.
It was like they made me do physical activity. Yeah. For all of you non-military law enforcement folk. So in certain phases, like the amount of regiment and lock and step type things would diminish the further you got into it. Like you had, you know, the colors of the flag, like red, blue, and white phase. Red phase is like
they're trying to weed everybody.
They tell you what to do, when to do it, like what leg to step with. You know, they tell you everything, how far. So we carried these smart books around with us. Like they're yay thick. They had everything you need to know to be a basic training soldier. And so at this particular time, we'd go up to the trial hall. Every time we stopped and we're stationary for longer than a second, we had to take our smart book out of our cargo pocket, open it up and read something, right? Hmm. So close it up, hold it, take one step, pick it back up, read it. Hold it, one step, you know, throughout the whole line.
Really?
Yeah. Excuse me. So my particular squad, we're the first ones in, and so we're the first ones out like 10 minutes later or whatever. Everything is regimented, like the trays.
Such a, man, the mastermind behind that.
yeah.
You know, like, that is so, like, the attention to detail.
Oh, for sure.
And, like, the constant, like,
way you hold your
like
cups.
Stay in thought. Like, stay ready all the time. Like, your brain never takes a break.
No.
And, like, the brilliance behind that is, like, because it's the same thing. Eventually, you're going to be stuck somewhere and... From a guy who's been on the perimeter of several search warrants, your mind starts to wander after about 10 minutes.
No, it instills discipline for sure.
Yeah.
That goes on. I mean, you can take that, what you're saying, and write a book about it. Like I was saying, there's a particular way you hold your cups. The particular way you stack your trays, everything has a... detail behind it, and that's it's like that for a reason. So the guy, we get outside and we have to go in formation. It's not just a gaggle. We stand there in formation, take out our smart books and read them. Well, there's a guy next to me who forgot our smart book in the barracks and nobody caught it yet.
Oh boy.
Yeah,
You gave him your smart book, you
no.
dummy.
No, oh. yeah. I didn't give him my smart book. Screw that. So we're standing there. I'm reading it, whatever, or trying not to fall asleep or something. And so he's just standing there at the position of attention or a parade rest or whatever. And the drill sergeant, you know, he's lollygagging, not doing anything. He's sitting on, like, the railing, and he's just, like, looking around. All of a sudden, he hones in on this guy next to me. Not having his smart book open, right? He comes over, like, he freaking walks, you know, speed walks over, and he's like, "Where's your smart book, Private?" And I'm like, "Oh, good, I'm so glad he's not yelling at me." He's like, "Private, take out your hands and act like you're reading your smart book." So he takes out his hands, and he's like reading a smart book. So the drill sergeant goes away. And about 30 seconds later, he's like, "Private, what are you reading out of your smart book?" Out of his fake smart book. His imaginary smart book. And he's like, "My general order is drill sergeant." He's like, "What's your second general order?" And he goes, "Duh, duh, and I point at his fake smart book. I go, "It's right there. Just read it." Oh, boy. That was the wrong thing to do.
You know he laughed about it after.
Oh, he had to have laughed. Yeah. Drill Sergeant Harris, not a shout out to you. So he beelines it towards me, and whenever there's more than one drill sergeant and this happens, like, then they're like, "Oh, I get to play too." So he's yelling in this ear and it's ringing, right? I have tinnitus now, thank you VA. No. No, I'm just kidding. Then he goes to this ear and yells in this ear, and then the other one comes, and now it's just like, oh my gosh, I don't even know what they're saying. Like, they're just yelling at me. And I'm just reading my smart book. And so they're yelling at me. And by this time, like, now there's a whole nother platoon outside from eating, right?
Oh, man.
They're like, "I want you to run around the formation," and saying, "Look at me, I like to embarrass my drill sergeant." I said, "Oh, okay. Roger that, drill sergeant." So I take off running. I said, "Look at me." I'm screaming. "Look at me, I like to embarrass my drill sergeant. Look at me, I like to embarrass my drill sergeant." And so after about 2 or 3 minutes, I start to use voice inflections, like different ones, like, "Look at me, I like to embarrass my drill sergeant." Like, I'm getting bored with myself. Goodness. And then they're like, "What is wrong with this guy?" And they're like, look at me, I like to smile." So I then say that for another 5 minutes. I'm out here for, it felt like forever. By the time the entire company comes out, I'm still there for 10 minutes running. I'm exhausted at this point. Like, I'm running fast. You know, I didn't want to embarrass myself. And screaming the entire time. And so, from then on out, it was Private Smiles. Yeah. And so, there's my favorite basic training story.
Dude, I feel like I could see that. You're the type of guy that, like, push it. You know? Like, push me.
Yeah.
I'll vomit, and then I'll get back up, and I'll run again.
So, basic training went well. I was Top Gun, boo-bang, the old pistola, for sure. I'm just kidding. Yeah. I remember people even tried to cheat on that test, because the way the test had it, you had to shoot so many from 35 yards.
People were holding them?
Yeah.
You know who did that?
Oh, my gosh.
Dude? Wolf. So when we had the SIGs and we used to shoot, because those SIGs are hard guns to shoot, man.
Yeah.
They have a forever trigger pull.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it's like a revolver trigger, okay, and a semi-automatic.
All right.
And when I first started, he's like, I think it was like 8 from 25 or something. He'd be like, "Don't shoot all 8. Like, what? He's like, "Just shoot 4. I'm like, "What?" He's like, "Yeah, if you throw a couple, you know, then like you get closer, you just... You know, if you're supposed to shoot 6, you shoot 7. I'm like, "What?" Yeah.
Okay. That's funny.
Keep an eye on him.
Yeah, firearms. Just between us. Yeah. That's funny. Yeah. Well, it was much like the same thing. Like, the guy would come back and he's like, "Hey."
He was in the Army too, so maybe he picked it up there. I don't know.
Yeah, he was. Yeah. Maybe he did. He was an MP too, I think.
I think he was. I think he was. At least I think he started as an MP.
Maybe he wasn't. I don't know. Basic training was fine. Then graduated November 8th, 2022. And on November 20th, I got married.
You said 2022. What?
2002. Okay. Did I say 22?
I think you did. This is
concussions. Yeah, yeah, 2002. Then got married November 20th, 2002. So then my wife and I got an apartment. We were both students full time.
Where was that at? Where'd you get to?
In the Quad Cities, Rock Island, Moline area, Davenport, Iowa, Bettendorf, Iowa. Those are the Quad Cities. That's why they call them the Quad Cities. There's four of them.
Yeah. One, two, three, four.
There's actually five. There's East Moline, too.
Really?
It doesn't have the same ring. It, Penta Cities. I don't know if that is the same.
Doesn't sound nearly as cool.
No. So, yeah, man, I guess I'm cheating a little bit because I've listened to your podcasts and talk about friendship and the relationships you build in the military. Mm-hmm. I talk to three or four guys on a weekly basis still.
Really?
Yeah. One is my best friend. He's a singer at the Honky Tonk Central in Nashville.
No way.
He'll actually be here Thursday. He sings at the Game 6 Honky Tonk every opening day for the Cardinals. So I'll be down there. I'll sing Tennessee Whiskey with him.
No way.
Yeah.
When is that?
When is it?
Yeah.
The opening day?
Yeah.
Thursday.
I'm trying to think of what day it is, see if I'm off.
Yeah. We'll go.
Yeah.
We'll leave early because I think Kristen wants to go too.
No way, dude. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Are those all guys that you're in boot camp with?
One went to boot camp with, and then we were in the same unit. Was in his wedding. We were in two deployments together. And then Luke and Jeremiah and David and a bunch of those guys, we were in either one or the other deployment. So let's see here. When did I get deployed? I got deployed, activated.
Was Kristen, you said that she was still in school?
Yeah.
What was she studying?
Sociology.
What?
With an emphasis in social work. She chose the major that would get her out of college the fastest.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so she has not done anything with that ever.
Really?
She went to apply for a job. This is how old
we are. Did she want to be like work for like children's division or something?
At first, I think like back in the day, she applied for a job in Springfield whenever we graduated, and it would have been an overnight job, and it was $7 an hour. With your degree, it was $7.25. So at that point, she's like, "My degree sucks." Yeah. It stinks. I'm sorry,
what
was Mom.
What did the position do?
I don't remember. It was like you're just there watching over like a shelter or something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you feel like that's something you guys bonded over, is like that want and need to serve other people?
I tell you what. Right now she works as a para in a resource room at an elementary school. And
shout out to my baby's elementary school.
Yeah, yeah. She had a story about her yesterday. She went to school as a nurse on your hero day.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Dude. I almost cried. Sorry, this is a side story.
No, I have that.
But, you know, like, police officers, all kids dress up as police officers, you know? And my wife, obviously, she's a nurse.
Yeah.
And it was so cool for me to see, like, my daughter look at her like you looked at your dad.
Yeah.
You know, like, it was so neat. And my wife's been through a lot, you know, and she's been on a journey, you know, and, like, hasn't always thought the best of herself, you know. And for her to see that same thing that you're talking about with your dad, for her to see her daughter look at her like she was her hero.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was like,
it's what you want.
It like almost melted me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was like, listen, I could be the tough cop guy, but I'm not afraid to be emotional and cry and everything else. It doesn't, you know, like I'm pretty confident in who I am. I don't feel like I need to like disguise my feelings or emotions to anybody anymore.
Yeah.
But it was just so neat to see that, like, she felt like, I could see it in my wife's eyes that she felt like so moved to know that her daughter looked at her like, you're my hero.
It's beautiful.
I know, dude. It was awesome. It was so cool.
But I'm sorry. I'm glad you shared that. That was awesome. Yeah, I mean, that's the same probably reason why your wife got into nursing is she wants to help people. Yeah. I know it sounds cliche, but honestly, like, even if you're not a faithful person, it's a very Christly thing to do, is to do our professions. Even teachers, you know, the majority of them get into because they want to help and, mm-hmm. and learn to kids.
Yeah.
Kristen worked for the Center for Autism for 7 years. And so she's always been super, super good with the behaviors and stuff like that. And so she's always had that need to be in that realm, and she's very good at it.
I think that's just part of, I don't know, like the nature of our, like if you're doing Christianity right, like you almost kind of have to be, I'm not saying you have to be in like a public service type thing, but like the whole goal of 1078 is like be the hands and feet, you know, like yeah. is to move. You know, like Christianity dies unless the people that are Christians actually do something with their faith.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And
love the Lord God with all your heart, but also love your neighbor as yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. Like there's action, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like for my wife and I, everybody always like, oh, you guys trauma bond. It's like, nah, bro, like we don't trauma bond. Like we're just, both of us feel like what we do for a living is a way to impact the kingdom on a regular basis and stay connected to God.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's probably where you and Christian are as well.
Oh, no doubt. No, she's like, I always say jokingly, if it wasn't for her, you know, I had a great childhood, and I want to get that across. But, you know, some people always joke around, there's some screws loose, you know?
Just a couple. It's like this.
Yeah, yeah.
The 7 concussions made.
Right, maybe, yeah, maybe. But, like, I attribute, and I thank God that he put her in my life, because had she not been in my life, I don't know where I'd be, you know?
Yeah.
I know that I probably would have done something way more dangerous, and God maybe have used me in that realm, you know, but the Lord gives us free will to make our own decisions, and, you know, he allows us to make decisions on our own, you know?
Yeah.
Obviously, he maybe there's arguments that he lays out your path for you, but he also gives you that you can either choose that path or not.
Choose to leave it, though.
Yeah. So, Kristen chose me, and I chose her through God. And it's been, obviously, there's no perfect relationship, but pretty darn close, I think. And if it wasn't for her, I don't know where I'd be, to be honest. I know that's kind of deep and dark, but having kids, there's nothing I will do that'll jeopardize not having them grow and be productive Christians and adults and stuff like that. So, like, that's where the morality comes from in my house, is there's nothing I want to do that will jeopardize that. I want to be there for them like my parents were for me.
Yeah.
And, So I thank God for her. Putting her in my life, for sure. Yeah.
It's the exact same feeling towards Kate. Like 100%. There's without... I didn't know if this conversation would go this way, but I was, like, as I was thinking about, you know, talking to you today, one of the things that struck me is, like, how inspirational your guys' marriage is. You know what I mean? Like, to see other cops that have successful marriages that... You guys are still actively loving each other. You guys have been together for a long time, but you're still actively in love with each other. You're still actively pursuing each other, although sometimes that looks goofy and silly. It's almost like, from an outside perspective, it seems like you're still dating. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like seeing you guys act like that, and like seeing your guys' relationship and the playful nature of it, and how you guys still act like sometimes you still act like you're like 18 together. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
I see you like
criticized for it sometimes.
Yeah, but but you like pursue her. You know what I mean? And you make her feel wanted. You know what I mean? And like, I've seen you do that. And then I look at Kate and I's relationship, and like, I'm a lot like that with her too. Like, I'm still constantly pursuing her. I'm still messing with her. And yeah, sometimes I say inappropriate things. Sometimes I do inappropriate things. But like, that's my wife, and I'm going to do inappropriate things with my wife. Amen. Not with anybody else.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But it's honestly inspirational to see another cop that we talked to. You talked at the very beginning, like balance, balance, balance. Like, life is balance. Like, everything, you know, you need to be the warrior, but you also need to be the lover. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
you need to be the joker, but you also need to be intelligent and make good, solid decisions under pressure.
Yeah.
And like, you do a very good job of balancing those things. And even like, as this conversation, I've been looking for that in you as we've been talking. So like, you've been joking, and then we get on like a serious topic, and it's like, switch, serious Montana.
Yeah.
And the next 5 minutes is a serious conversation. Then it may go back to joking and then back to a serious conversation. But man, it gets disheartening sometimes as like a young policeman to watch guys just sabotage their marriages
for sure,
over and over and over again. And it's inspirational to see another guy that's been through it, that's been a cop for a long time, that's been through deployments, that has kids, actively pursuing his wife and actively pursuing like a solid relationship and not willing to jeopardize, like you just said, not willing to jeopardize everything that he's created and the beauty of marriage and the beauty of family for 5 minutes of fun.
Mm.
You know what I mean? So your hard work with your wife and your willingness to pursue her, it doesn't go unnoticed. You know what I mean? Like, at least for me, I noticed it.
No, and as you're talking, there's like calls that come to mind. There's like people give social media, a bad rap, which obviously there's a lot of bad things about social media, but they're like, people aren't real on social media. They want to project who
highlight reels
of their life. And I can tell you, I can honestly tell you, like, yeah, do Kristen and I get in some arguments every once in a while? Yeah, I can't tell you the last time or what the last one was about. I can. It had to do with a curfew, babe. No. but for real, it's all about communication. Like, there's three things I say on SWAT is that'll hurt somebody, that'll get somebody hurt, get somebody killed. That's hands, angles, and communicate. If you pay attention to those three things, you're going to do fine, right? And what I mean by that, for people listening, is there's a phrase called tactical gaze, where whenever you go into a high stress situation or even a normal call, you're constantly looking for somebody's hands. What are they doing with their hands? It's very rare in the United States that somebody has a suicide vest on, right?
Yeah.
Or
hands kill.
Yeah. Or I've heard of people being shot with a toe, right? So I look for hands. I also want to look for angles. Like, what are the best angles that I can get on somebody to make sure I go home at the end of the night, right? If I enter a room, what are the best angles for dominating this room? If I see a bad guy, like, I don't want to stand directly in front of him. Like, you talk to professional fighters or amateur fighters. Like, you don't openly, the way you win is you get angles on people. Jiu-jitsu, the name of the game is angles, right? Then communicate. Every AAR, after action review that I've ever been a part of, in the military and police, communication has always been the number one thing that has either fallen apart or needs to improve. Now, the successful missions, people are like, our communication was really good.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so if you apply those to relationships, not necessarily hands and angles, but you can. I mean, we could go there. You can, but communication is the number one thing. Like, and not being, you're not in a competition with your spouse, right? You're not playing games at this point in our marriage. And even when we were brand new, married or engaged or something like that, not once am I ever in competition with her to see, like, or playing games. Like, so if I have advice for couples, I've married, I think, 4 or 5 couples so far.
slight flex.
Yeah. if I had advice, it's like, don't, there's no such thing as over communicating, right? Because if you tell somebody truly how you feel, you got to set boundaries. Like, hey, listen, this is what I want to talk about, and go through that realm. Like, don't hold stuff back, because if you hold stuff back, like kind of like you alluded to earlier, there's a potential of it exploding. Like, your cup is full, mm-hmm. right? Your bucket's full.
Yeah.
And once it gets to that point, you're going to say something you regret, or it's going to be under some type of personal duress or something like that. So that's one key that we've always had. Like, Kristen's rule, it's annoyed the crap out of me, but it's so awesome. We have never in 21 and a half years, 2024, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
We have never gone to bed angry, because she won't go to bed angry. Me, I'm a man, right? Like, I follow from my dad. I don't think he holds grudges. Like, I don't hold grudges. I enjoy everybody that I can come in contact with, because life's too short to be mad at somebody, I think. Mm-hmm. Even if, and forgiveness is obviously a huge part of that.
Right. Yeah.
To forgive, truly forgive somebody, is that's a whole different other topic. But going to bed angry never happened in my house, ever. I have acted like I was asleep, and she's poking me in the back. Hey. Oh. I'm like, what? I said, I'm over it, you know? And she's like, we need to finish this conversation. I'm like, all right, let's do it. And so I attribute her with that aspect of our relationship of that. You know, and all that is communication. And there's always been standards set and everything like that. And even when I've faltered in that communication, that's maybe when we've had arguments, is because I didn't communicate or she didn't communicate. That's the number one thing, right? And I have a story about communication in Iraq. The first deployment in 2004, we were kind of in a battalion sized element in this FOB, kind of closer to Iran. Anybody in the military listening, it was by Bakuba or Anaconda. That was two of the main bases close to us. But something, I don't remember why I said it, but I was on the phone with her, and it was like, I forget how often we talked, like once a week or maybe, because we had to buy minutes back then. And so I was on the phone with her, and I told her, hey, I said, you know what, blah, blah, blah. I'm going on a convoy tomorrow, and Intel has IEDs all along the route. And that's the way I left the conversation.
Oh, man.
And I'm like, you know, at the time, I was, I don't know, it didn't even warrant that, but that's just kind of how I, you know, that's what happened. I was freaking 20 years old or whatever, you know, I said something stupid. And she's like, don't ever do that again. She's like, and rightfully so, she's like, you don't know what I'm feeling right now. She's like, now I got to worry about you for the next day or two or whatever, the next time I talk to you.
Yeah.
Luckily, no, you know, nobody in our unit was killed or nothing bad happened to us. But I mean, that's the communication, that if it breaks down, that could have ended very, very badly.
Yeah. That was a giant learning curve for me whenever I met Kate, because I grew up in my mom is Italian, and they love hard, but they fight hard.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So it's not really uncommon for, when I was younger, for us to get into arguments, like my family to get into arguments with each other, and we would say like the most cutthroat things to each other. But then like an hour later, it'd be like, hey, sorry about that. You know, like, I still love you.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, that was a very common.
Yeah.
Super, super common. Like, I didn't grow up in a household where it was a very Jesus focused household. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, my parents were doing the best I think that they could at that time. You know, we didn't have a lot of money, and there's a lot of stress in their lives, I think, And overall, I had a fairly good childhood, you know.
Yeah.
I recall it as a good childhood, but I've also had a bunch of concussions as well. So, you know, I don't have the best memory either. But that was like a huge learning curve for Kate and I, because she came from a very, the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. nobody yelled. They didn't have conversations like that. So like when we first started dating, I was like a 21-year-old kid. Just got into law enforcement, like stressed to the max, like, you know, like trying to like not fail at this job.
Yeah.
I just bought a house. I got all these things going on in my life. And then I'm dating this girl. And every time we get into an argument, I just explode. And I would say like the most ignorant, cutthroat things, man. Mm-hmm. And then like an hour later, I'd be like, sorry about that. You know, I still love you, you know, like I still care about you. And then it eventually got to the point where, like, that happened a couple times. And she's like, listen, you could say sorry, but sorry doesn't mean anything to me because you keep saying these things to me.
Yeah.
And she literally, it was like the third argument that we ever had. She's like, you either need to address the way that you're acting or I'm done. Like,
yeah.
And I knew very, very on, like early on in our relationship, that something was special there. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It sounds like so cliche, man, and I hate to say it, but like I think I told her that I loved her like after 2 weeks of knowing her.
Yeah.
You know, like I just knew. Like we just clicked, man. It was like
yeah.
she was my person. Like we understood each other very well. And I really enjoyed being around her. And I was like, all right, well I'm gonna fix it. And it took me a long time to relearn communication.
Right.
You know what I mean? It was very hard. And you said not being competition, and like every fight that I got into at my house, like at like with my family, was like somebody has to win this.
Yeah.
It's like there's a winner and a loser of this conversation. Yeah. And the loser, you don't want to be the loser, you mm-hmm. want to be the winner. So whoever says the most cutthroat, hard thing mm-hmm. that makes the other person cry first, that's the winner.
Yeah.
And I was doing that to my future wife. Holy cow. You know what I mean? Yeah. You know what I mean? I was like attacking her as a person.
Yeah.
And like I didn't mean the things I was saying. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't mean them at all.
That was your culture in your house.
Yeah, I was just saying that because that's what I had known. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And, like, and now it's almost sometimes, like, if I get into an argument with my parents, I'd be like, now it's like, yeah, I'm not talking to you.
You know what I mean? Right.
Like, I'm not going to be on the phone with them. I'm not going to yell at you. You're not going to yell at me. Like, how about you call me back in a little bit and we could actually talk about this? It's like I've relearned that communication. And since then, since like I've really focused on like being accountable for the words that come out of my mouth, like we live and die by the tongue, right? Our fights never get to that level.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They never get like arguments never get to that level where like I'm saying things that I don't mean. Just to hurt someone's feelings, you know? And man, it's been a game changer. You know, it's not being in competition. Kate's dad said when we first got married, he said, if you decide that you're going to serve your spouse, you'll have a successful relationship.
For sure.
If you can stay in that servitude to your spouse and decide to put them first rather than yourself, you'll have a successful marriage. And
as you're talking, I'm thinking about one word, and I'm not trying to sound smart here, but because I just heard on a podcast a couple days ago, is St. Augustine was asked, like, describe Christianity in three words. And I may be jacking this up, but the gist of it is, he said, humility, humility, humility. That's what it is to be a Christian, right? And if you apply that to your relationships, not only your spouse, but just in general, if it comes from an angle of humility, then you cannot go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not saying that you can't have
disagreements.
You can't have disagreements, or you can't have confidence and humility at the same time. Those things are synonymous. Like mm-hmm. you can have confidence and humility.
Yeah.
But there's a way. This is something I always tell my kids. It's not what you say, it's how you say it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like
I'm sorry different.
Nailed it.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Like those are two different.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nailed it. Yeah. So there you go. Oh, Oh, I know what I was going to talk about. We're talking about like a particular call that came to mind as you were talking earlier about balance, and I mean, humility has a little bit to do with it. Is a lot of time you're hard nosed police officers that are just extremely type A. People say sharks because they're the apex. I don't say sharks. I say orcas because those are the true apex predators in the sea. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Those eat great whales. Great whales.
Maybe those too, dude.
Great whites. Great whales too. Yeah. For breakfast, you know. Is turning it off and turning it on. If you don't have humility in that, then you can't go from one extreme to the next. Like, you can't kick in a door and then be like, I need to be there for somebody.
Yeah.
Right? That's I think humility is a great attribute as a police officer too.
I think it's necessary. It's like you watch these videos of cops get like caught in that like cycle, like sometimes like the constitutionalist people, mm-hmm. you know, like they mm-hmm. back cops into corners.
Oh, yeah.
And the cop is obviously wrong.
It's ego.
But he can't say he's wrong and just say, hey, man, you got me. So he just keeps doubling down and looking more and more and more dumb over and over. And the guy's just got him in a corner, just poking him.
Yeah.
And eventually they freak out and they take the dude to jail or something. You know what I mean? Like, they eventually lose it. Like, and they can't. It's okay to not, like, you're right, bro. You win.
Yes.
See ya. Like,
that's it.
Like, bye.
I can't tell you, like, how many times where I've, it's almost like using reverse psychology on somebody. It's so I forget. It was my wife actually was doing a ride along with me back in the day. Like,
dude, Kate would have a stroke if she rode in my car. She'd fall out.
Yeah. So we ended up arresting this dude who was acting a fool. I think it was on St. Patty's Day, like 10 years ago or something. And he was acting a fool, just drunk off his butt. Yeah, I think we picked him up in the QT parking lot. I think, and all I was doing is transporting him for somebody. We had to take him to get a fit for confinement. So he's spitting everywhere in the back seat, and he's like, "I made love to your mother," but he said it in a different way, right?
One of those bad words.
He said the F word. And my wife's right here, you know? And I was like, that's weird. So did I. And the dude's like, he wanted to get a rise out of me, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, sorry, bro. You got, I don't care what you say. Like, say what you want.
Hey, just, you know, I'm the guy that ran around the whole platoon saying, I like to embarrass my drill sergeant.
Yeah. I like to embarrass my mother.
You're right, though, dude. Humility is like, it's hard to humble yourself. You know, it's like sometimes we talk about this all the time because my ego is like my worst enemy. You know what I mean? It's like, and to be 100% transparent, like 1078 is the first thing I've probably ever done in my entire life that doesn't have an ego behind it. Like, I wanted to be successful, no doubt. Like, but at the end of the day, like, this is God's plan, not my plan. So what happens with it is what happens with it. And I've been able to, for the first time, be able to disassociate like my own personal goals to like what 1078 is meant to do. But that's not normal to me. You know what I mean? Like,
you know what though? Like, and the byproduct of being humble is like, for instance, I'll use you as a personal example. Anybody that I've talked to about this in your podcast specifically was like, that is so well done. You know, Matt's doing a pretty awesome thing. Like, he's doing a great job. I was like, what would I do in Matt's shoes? And I think for me, it would be I don't want to say like the business I'm starting, but it's like, I'm afraid of failure. Right.
Yeah, sure.
But the thing is, the byproduct of you being humble in this is success, right? Everybody that I've talked to is like, this is awesome. I'm so glad he's doing this. It's 2024 and this hasn't been done yet. This is crazy.
It's bizarre to me too, dude. I can't believe it.
It's insane. So, I mean, kudos to you, because it's probably your confidence, and not in a bad way, a confidence in a good way, that's caused you to do this for other people. And because you're coming at it from a position of humility, and I've seen it firsthand. I think I was with you on your first one.
Yeah.
And it's like, you said something very nice at the very beginning about me, but to reciprocate that to you is like, I've never been more proud as seeing you growing up with you throughout your career, like being in your first roll call, I think. I've never been more proud of another police officer than seeing you help others the way you have.
Thanks, man.
It's been awesome to watch, beautiful and humbling to be a part of.
I appreciate it. And I'm not like this. None of this is possible without God. You know me. I'm not smart. You know, like, the fact that this has not, that it's 2024 and nobody else is doing this, and that I'm the guy that's doing it, that's all that's good God, stuff, man. You know what I mean?
For sure.
It has to be. You know what I mean? I'm not the sharpest crayon in the box. I'm a super passionate crayon. You know what I mean? But I'm not the smartest guy in the world, you know? So, God has definitely given me a lot of wisdom and guidance and surrounded me by a lot of very, very smart people that are willing to push this thing in the right direction. And he's gifted me with Kate, who is willing to step forward and tell me when I'm being a tool bag and when I need to cool my jets. You know what I mean? And, you know, it's
probably in a calm way.
Yeah, dude. Yeah. Yeah. A way that I can actually understand and process and not get angry. But it's not just me. There's a lot of people behind the scenes that, you know, from Mark to Kate to you guys that are going out there and delivering packages for me and with me. And it's a lot of people that are behind it that are not just me. And all the ideas that I have are just ideas that I've gotten from other people. You know what I mean? Like, some of it comes from our own personal experience, Kate and I's own personal experience, but a lot of it is,
hey, I want to try this. Yeah.
Yeah. Talking to a lot of other people that have been through officer involved shootings and wives and trying to, I don't know, pull out the best ideas that we can from a bunch of
different
minds. So,
for sure.
Appreciate you, dude. But let's jump back to your deployments real quick. So, you said your first deployment was when?
I got activated in December 2003. So, we did a month of training and then. So, actually, being a newbie, like, I forget what day it was, but we were on our way to my nephew's birthday party when I got the call from a buddy. He's like, hey, did you hear? I said, no, what? He goes, we're getting deployed. I said, nobody's called me yet. He goes, well, just wait for the phone call. So, not 10 seconds later after I got the phone with him, I'm like, hey, Steven's over. Report this day. I'm like, that's in 5 days.
No way.
Yeah. That's in 5 days, bro. And so just imagine. I'm not saying this like, look at me, but 2003, right? The war in Iraq, it kicked off in, I think, March of that year.
Yeah.
On your way to a family gathering, and you're like, I'm going to war.
What was the thought process, dude? How old are you then? Like 20?
I was 20, yeah.
That had to throw you for a loop.
It did. I remember my brother, like, we talked that night. Like, you know, if it's my time, it's... I remember the exact conversation, actually. I don't know why, but we talked about death. I said, I believe that God sometimes uses people, if you can affect more people with your death, meaning like
Pat Tillman.
Yeah. If he can use you in that way, I don't let his will be done.
Yeah.
Like, that's how my faith is. You know, it's not to get sidetracked again on faith, but as a Christian, everything should, like, God and Jesus, Holy Spirit, they come first in your life, right? Mm-hmm. If it's not ordained by God, like, that's the reason why we're talking right now. That's the reason why all of our cells are talking to each other, our DNA is like, you know, floating around somewhere in our body. Everything is a direct relation to him. We just had the resurrection 2 days ago. I've watched so many like little TikToks and stuff like that on the resurrection and Easter and stuff like that. And it's just amazing. The information, the knowledge and everything like that, that it works through you, through God and into that. So in that realm, like that's where I want to tell people I'm coming from. Like, you know, if God decides it's my time to go, it's my time to go. Like, I'm not afraid of it. Like as a human, yeah, I'm afraid of death. I don't want to die. Mm-hmm. But if God can affect more people with my death than I can alive, I know that sounds like nuts to somebody who's not a Christian, but that's the way I feel.
I've prayed that prayer a million times. No joke, dude.
Yeah.
Literally, I say that in my head, like, every time I'm going on something hot, like, your will, your way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I trust you.
It's powerful.
Like, your will, your way. And, dude, sometimes it's like the human side of me is like, I really don't want it to be that way.
For sure.
You know, the Christian side of me is like, if what I believe is true, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm going to somewhere way better than this.
For sure.
You know what I mean?
We talk about the priority of life in planning, right? It's called PIE. You have your priority of life, your intel environment, and tools available and officer instincts, but PIE to you. Anywho, that was a little lesson for all you people. But PIE is a priority of life. You know, it goes... Hostages, innocents, emergency personnel, bad guys. Then you apply that to the Bible. No greater love than a man that gives his life for another, right? That's our priority as police officers is biblical, right? When people wrap their heads around that, it's like an eye-opening thing. Like every time I see that, I'm like, I think of that verse.
Yeah.
There's no greater love than that priority over my life. So, okay. So, that's a conversation.
Deep, man. I love it.
Daggone, it's deep. Yeah. I remember having that conversation with my brother that night and not knowing our mission or anything, what's going on. I knew that was going to happen, right? Not that I was going to die, but like that was a possibility. So the first deployment, it was, I had a great time. I don't know. We slept on cots for 10 and a half months. And there's like 8 of us, I think, in a tent, and that we just had the best time together.
What were you guys doing?
Our primary mission was it's kind of confusing. We were guarding Iranians in Iraq. We were called the PMOI. People's Mujahideen of Iran, or the MEK. They were basically people from Iran that did not agree with Iranian regime, and Saddam Hussein used them at his beck and call. They're the ones that gassed the Kurds. Mm-hmm. And so they're like his own little mercenary division. So we rolled in there, and basically the guys that we were guarding wanted out of the PMOI. It's, once again, it's a little confusing. But we guarded these people. They're like detainees, if you will. We also did a little base defense. There's a bunker complex. That was the closest I came to dying over there, was when the EOD accidentally destroyed months' worth of bombs, artillery shells, and stuff like that.
They accidentally?
Yeah, I don't know how it happened, but it was the sky was black for hours. It was just one explosion after another. It was like, you know, like the little mushroom cloud.
Yeah.
It wasn't nuclear, or else I wouldn't be here talking to you, but it was very, very large, like hundreds of tons of explosives every time. And it was even at, they ranged from probably half a mile to 2 miles away for hours.
No way.
And I was in between. I was the closest American at the time.
Somebody got in trouble.
Somebody got in trouble. Let me turn this off. I don't know. It wasn't like I was actually laughing until I was told to get out of the tower. Because you could hear the munitions, like you could see it land, like on the other side of me. And it was one of those things where like, well, I guess God, if you want me to go, I hope not, because this is a dumb way to die.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a oopsie by somebody. But yeah, we did convoys. Nothing like, I don't have any cool stories like Joe or Ben and Adi. They had some pretty crazy stories.
Yeah.
I accidentally caused a hunger strike. Because one of my buddies who was a platoon sergeant at the time dared me to go hug one of the detainees. And I was like, what? He goes, yeah, it'd be funny. So I went and hugged him, and then everybody thought like he was on our side.
No way.
So it caused a little.
Did they stop eating?
No. Well, yeah, a lot of them stopped eating for a while. I don't know if there's statute of limitations on that, but no, that's fine. That's fine. I actually just told this story to Aubrey, my 15-year-old, a few days ago. I don't know how we got in the topic, but eventually this goes for like stress too. If you don't find something to do, like you're going to get into some trouble. Right. So these guys started getting some trouble because they didn't have rec time. They were confined to their tents and like dirt is what they had. So we built them a soccer field to get the energy out and stuff like that. And I remember my platoon leader went on leave. So he was like our moral compass. he came back from leave and he sees me playing soccer with these Iranians. And that's right. I told Aubrey, I said, I'm the only American to score a goal on them. She's like, Daddy, you don't even play soccer. I was like, well, I had a taser. So I just run with the ball as I put in my taser at these terrorists.
No way.
Yeah, it's good times. Yeah, it's a good time. Dude. I tased one in the gooch. Can we say that?
You could say gooch.
Not during the soccer game. He took a bunch of pills and had a tent pole. He was waving at everybody. So our LT shot him, and then we went to go put hands on him. And I was 20 years old. I had nothing better to do but tase that dude in the gooch, you know?
How long was that deployment?
It was just under a year. It was like 10 and a half months, I think.
Okay. Seems to be like the norm, like around 10 to 11 months seems to be around the norm.
Yeah, so my wife and I, it was 2004. Yeah, we didn't have any kids then. So came back from Iraq in October. Yeah, October.
So when you say, hold on, I just want to go back real quick. When you say you're guarding these people, were you guarding them from, who are you guarding them from?
See, that's the confusing part is.
Were they like detainees? Because they're a terrorist, or yeah. Were they like stuck in the middle where nobody liked them?
Correct.
Okay.
That makes sense. That's probably the best way I've ever heard it explained. Thank you for that. Okay. They were stuck. You're exactly right. So it's funny because the State Department and the FBI came over to interview every single one of them to try to find them homes because nobody wanted them. And they were classified as terrorists at one point. Yeah.
Do you have any idea where they ever got sent?
Yeah. I got one of them ended up being like a telemarketer and got a hold of one of the soldiers over there.
Huh?
Like back in the States.
No.
Yeah.
So they came back to the United States?
A couple of them did. Yeah. So it's kind of awkward.
Were they like, I'm guessing, cooperative?
Yeah. So those were like your trustees, like the guy who would interpret for us. There's another guy named Francis who was a professional torturer. He was an eye doctor trained at Oxford. So like we had guys like that too that were just insanely brilliant, smart, but yet they tortured people for a living.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I'm guessing he came back and was an eye doctor somewhere?
I don't think he's around anymore. I don't think he's practicing.
Does he offer a military discount?
Maybe. I don't know. Francis, if you're listening. Yeah.
Shout out.
Yeah. What up, dog?
No way, man.
Yeah. So it was...
Professional torturer.
I mean, that's right. That's... Yeah, he tortured people. That was the...
Dude, what the heck?
But yeah, man. Like some of the... I got a funny story. At one point, we conducted a reset. Like, things were... We're finding a bunch of knives. Like, there's no discipline in the camp. It was kind of when we first got over there. And so our commander at the time was a pretty awesome dude. He's one of my former heroes. Shout out, Colonel Weib. So
I'm going to have to tag so many people in this post.
Oh, yeah, sure. So he was like, all right, take everything from them and just give them the bare minimum, you know. But so that was all hands on deck. So I worked a 36-hour shift that day, days. And for whatever reason, like I would never do that now, but they sent myself and my buddy Mitch and into this. It was like one of the better behaved camps. Like there's, I think, six different camps, right? There's like a shoe area, which is like special housing where isolation, like those are the bad dudes. So you go there for 10 days or whatever and come back after you do something stupid. Then there's people like a guy named Saeed Pakdel who had to stay there because he would like voluntarily get raped a lot.
What?
Yeah, dude, I don't know.
Didn't sound like rape.
I mean, he was up for it, yeah. But even when he wasn't, yeah. You know what I mean? So shout out Saeed Pakdel. So I got in trouble one time. I was in a tower, and he was down below, and I was working overnights, and I yelled his name for hours. And he's like, why? I'm like, I got nothing else to do.
He's like, why?
So I don't know if, yeah, that's fine. Whatever. what was I saying? Oh, how about Saeed?
36-hour shift.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So me and my buddy Mitch, we accidentally sat on this cot armed with less lethal. Shotgun, which for those of you listening, a less lethal shotgun contains munitions. This particular munition was a fin stabilized rubber projectile.
That hurt.
Yeah, that would hurt. So being 30 hours into it, it's nighttime. We sat back to back just like Forrest Gump and his buddy.
You guys fell asleep?
We fell asleep.
No way.
And the reason why we woke up is... from a tap on the shoulder from one of the detainees. Like, Sergeant, you are sleeping.
No.
Yeah, yeah. So we stood up. We didn't sit back down after that. Sorry.
So what was the overall feel from those guys? Like, were they relatively, I'm guessing, by you guys keeping them detained, they were able to avoid some type of persecution.
Yes and no. Like, I think they came to us because a lot of people have, like, fled to us whenever we took over everything because they wanted to get away from the people, thinking they would because they knew that, and this happened. I mean, you can Google it. After the Americans left Iraq and that area, mm-hmm. The Iraqi army came and massacred dozens of them. I think it was dozens of them. So, yeah, they fled to us because they didn't want to get killed by the Iraqis that hated them. It was a Shia-Sunni type thing, mm-hmm. You know. And the PMY was actually not like religious zealots or anything like that. They were just anti-Iran. Because some of them even claimed they were Christian coming into our camp.
They're anti-Iran, but they were... working with
Saddam, yeah, because they hated each other at that time.
Really?
Yeah,
because now they're close again, right?
I don't know. I don't know what their relationship. I don't think Iran's nice to anybody. I don't know what their relationship is now. But yeah,
Interesting.
Yeah, so I don't think we told anybody about that. This is the first time I've ever mentioned it.
You just passed out. excuse me, sir. You're sleeping on my cot.
Yeah, so that was pretty fun. I got real good at IVs because it was hot. There was one detainee that he had seizures that were initiated because of dehydration. Oh, and really? In the desert, that's not a good combination, right? Yeah. So I gave him IVs a lot.
Is the old thing really stay true where it's like super hot during the day, super cold during the night?
During particular seasons, yeah. It's really weird if you talk to people in the desert, like there's no coldness like it. Like there would be I mean, it wasn't like scorching hot during the day, but like on the days where it would be like 80, 90, and it would be 35, 36 during the night, your feet hurt, everything hurt. It was just a weird cold. Can't explain it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, yeah, we didn't lose anybody. I mean, we, a bunch of our convoys got hit with IDs but nothing crazy. I got back in October, went to the police academy in April of the next year, the Eastern Missouri Police Academy. And graduated from that, and then I actually applied to two different places.
What was it like going from the military to the police academy? Did they send you through protocol and everything?
Yeah, I don't remember protocol because I don't think it really fazed me.
I always wondered that perspective because I was like a young 20-year-old. I was 20 years old when I was in the academy.
Yeah.
Like I had like very limited life experience. And, like, even then, I rustled. And, like, they're like, we're going to run you. I was like, I'll run until I die.
Oh, you'd be fine.
Yeah.
That's what I tell Gunnar, my son. Like, he does football, and he did a little wrestling in middle school. But, like, when they have hard workouts, and he's talking about going into the military. I said, if you go in, I want you to try to be the best. You know, I want you to try to be a ranger or special forces or something. I don't want you to just go in. No offense to anybody who's joining and just wants to join, but I said, if you do it, I want you to not have any regrets like your old man. I'm living my dreams through him vicariously. Yeah. I think that's what a parent should do. Just kidding. But, you know, I feel that for him. And I said, dude, if you can make it through the hard workouts, you're going to be fine. It's all a mental game. That's all it is.
Yeah, man, I'm that wrestling room, bro.
Stupid.
The stuff that we did.
Yeah.
You know, like.
It's the best individual sport in high school to get you ready for life.
It's just mental strength.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the amount of mental strength you had to have. Not only are you running nonstop and they got the room turned up to 103 and you're cutting weight, you haven't, at least me, I hadn't eaten anything but a cup of peaches in a day and drank one bottle of water, dude.
Peaches.
Yeah. That's what I would eat. I'd drink one bottle of water and a cup of peaches.
And your kidneys are shot from now on.
Dude, they probably are for sure. Yeah. But like, and then you go work out. And I had morning practice. I'd wake up 4 o'clock in the morning. I go to morning practice, go to school, have weightlifting in the middle of the day, go to afternoon practice, and then leave with one of my coaches. And we go to SIUE or Mizzou for night practice. And then I'd go home and I'd run like 12 miles to cut weight. Yeah, dude.
Legit.
Yeah, dude. And I would do that. Over and over and over. I'll tell you what, man.
That's way worse.
There's an animal side and a human that I don't think anybody accesses until you're really hungry.
Mm-hmm.
Like a funny story is when I was like 16, 17 years old, it was wrestling season. I was cutting weight. And you know, there's only certain things you can eat when you're cutting weight. Like, you know, a cup of peaches. Or like
peaches,
you'd have like which, dude, they're so refreshing. But
it is hilarious.
Or you'd have like a rice cake, and you'd spread like peanut butter on it. And I came home, and I was hungry, dude. I was really hungry, and my sister ate my rice cakes.
Oh man,
dude, I promise you, almost killed her.
Yeah,
like I was so mad.
I don't think anybody would blame me.
I was so angry. I was like, you can eat anything that you want.
Yeah.
That's all I can eat.
Yeah.
I almost lost it, dude. Like, I literally, I think the only reason why I didn't kill her is because everybody else was home. You know, like, my parents were able to, like, calm me down, dude. I was, it's probably the most mad I've ever been in my entire life. And, like, I think you can only access that.
That's legit. You're,
like, that hungry.
You know what's funny is I just read an article on a 7-day water fast. I've done 4
7-day water?
Yeah, so I've done done 4 72-hour fasts within the last year. And I backed it off to 5 days. So I think next month I'm going to do a 5-day water fast. So we'll see how it goes. I'll let you know. I'll keep you updated.
Yeah. Yeah, dude.
I'll see. I promise I won't kill anybody.
I don't think it would be as bad if it was like a voluntary thing and I wasn't burning like 4,000 calories a day.
Oh, for sure.
Eating 600. But
you're not just not eating. Yeah. You're also expending a lot of calories. Yeah.
I remember one time I was in wood shop class in high school and I thought I was going to die because I hadn't drank any water. And every time I took a drink, every time I swallowed my spit, it burnt my throat. And I was like, I think something seriously wrong. Healthy. Here.
I don't know. Do they have laws on that now?
I think I might die. Weight? Yeah, but they all cheated it, dude. So, like, they would do like a body fat index. Right. So you would go to like a coach of a different team and our coach would do their guys. They would do our guys.
Oh, but they'd just talk to each other.
They'd just gauge it and be like, 7. I'm like looking down. I'm like, that does not say 7, dude. No. You know, so they would just, you know, finagle the system. But as far as mental strength, you know, it's like I don't think that there's any other high school or collegiate sport that could ever give you that type of mental strength.
But I agree with you.
I don't know if I'd ever let my kids. I don't know if I would let my kids at least wrestle the way that I did, where I was cutting, you know, a large amount of weight, dehydrating myself.
At what point is it counterintuitive?
I ended up getting stress fractures in my back my junior year because I was so like malnourished.
Yeah.
But you know, it is what it is. But I forget what we were talking about now that we that I went on that rant about.
Oh, dang.
You were leaving your deployment.
Yeah, police academy.
Oh yeah.
And just realizing protocol. It's not a big deal.
Yeah.
And you just gotta make like it's 4 hours the rest of your life. Like you can do anything for 4 hours.
Yeah.
You know?
And they don't even really
unless you're truly hurt.
They don't really do anything that they just make you run.
No, I think I've done it. I haven't done it in a couple of years. I joke around. I got a buddy who's a police officer now, and he's not a PT stud by any means, but he tries hard at everything he does. He was in formation, and we're working these kids pretty hard, you know, and he's about to throw up. And we're like, don't you throw up in my formation, you know, something stupid like that. Like, please do.
Yeah. I want to see this.
And so he does not break attention. And he throws up. He throws up at the position of attention all over the chick in front of him.
No.
Yeah. And we're like, what are you doing? Like, we weren't serious. Go freaking throw up in the bushes, you know? Like, that was awesome. Good for you. You're disciplined at least. Checkmate, I guess.
Dude, that's awesome.
Yeah, that was legit. That was one of my favorite protocol day stories.
I think that like, I didn't have any problem with protocol at all. I literally, you can't break me like that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
No.
I will run with everything until I pass out.
Yeah.
Like, that doesn't.
Or until somebody trips you going downhill starting the mile in elementary school and you get a concussion. Yeah.
But the.
OC?
Yeah.
I read sign language.
Yeah, that sucked, dude.
Oh, for sure.
It is. Yeah. Not that it was like, again, not that it was anything that would like deter me from being a policeman, but that stuff sucks.
Yeah. No, it does suck. I've probably been exposed to CS gas, I don't know, dozens of times.
I've heard there's so many stories about you exposed to CS gas.
Yeah, I don't like to have clothes on when I do it. OC is so much worse.
Oh my goodness, dude, it's so stupid. Bad.
We just we were exposed to pepper ball stuff today, and it's like you're like OC is so much worse.
Oh, dude, it's CS, when you walk away, it goes away.
Goes away. Almost immediately.
Yeah, so if you just, like, deal with it, like, you can, again, get into your own head and just be like, it's all going to stop in a second.
Yep.
Then you're fine. But, man, OC is... It doesn't stop.
No, no.
It just 30, keeps going.
30, it doesn't, there's no matter what you, what no, fake
the milk thing,
ailment prevention thing you.
Doesn't work.
No, nothing works.
Matt Wagner said, I don't know if you listened to his.
I did.
He said that they have magic drops.
God
that,
bless
like, numb
him.
Your eyeballs.
Yeah. Yeah.
That work. But other than that, man.
We can get a hold of those.
Yeah. I need some of those.
Yeah,
that'd be great.
That'd be neat.
I'd probably put OC back on my belt if I had some of those drops.
Right.
Every time I've ever seen it used in real life,
it's
a disaster.
It is a disaster.
It doesn't. It hurts everyone.
I remember field training. I got it out, and my field trainer was like, "Put that away." I'm like, "Why?" He's like, "Don't use that in front of me."
Well, because it just exposes everyone.
Yeah, yeah. And if you're, it's going to get on you. There's going to be some residual for sure.
Yeah, it sucks. I hate all that good stuff. But that's the only things from the academy that really stand out to me were. Watching everybody else almost fail protocol, which I thought was a joke.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I thought it was a joke that they were quitting. Like, we had guys who were like, I need to go to the hospital. And I was like, as a 20-year-old kid, I'm like, dude, are you serious? Like, you're about to throw away the rest of your life because you had to run.
For sure. I always ask people, like, that are struggling bad. I was like, what have you done prior to this to prepare yourself for this day that you know is coming? You knew it was coming.
I always thought to myself, like, hey, man, if guys can go through, like, hell week, and people can make it through buds.
For 4 hours. Why can't I do this?
If I can't do this for like you see the pictures of the guys that go through buds and their heads are bald from the boat sitting on top of their heads.
Yeah.
Like if that guy's mentally capable of doing this,
mm-hmm.
how are you not capable of just, it's like a couple hours, dude.
No idea.
You know, like it's going to be okay. We're not going to die here.
Yeah.
I personally think they should make it way harder. Like I think it should be really hard.
The problem is, well, you found what state was that I just read? They like basically just took away their physical standards or made it so easy that.
Did you see that article that I think it was Detroit? I this is not made up.
Yeah.
This is 100% serious. I watched a recruiting video that said that they got rid of all their physical standards. And then the second part of the video was like, if you have municipal warrants, I'm not joking, dude.
I didn't see that.
100%.
Oh, my gosh.
Like, if you have, I'm going to find it, and I'm going to freaking put in the show notes for this thing.
Yeah.
But it said, like, if you have municipal warrants, we'll help you take care of your municipal warrants. And I thought to myself, how is that guy doing the same job as me?
No idea. And you wonder why there's any corruption or anything like that.
Yeah. It's like, oh, my goodness, man, what are we
doing? No offense if you have municipal warrants.
Offense if you have municipal warrants, dude. Like, you can't do this job.
You can't do it.
You know, like,
you can't do it.
You shouldn't be able, like, not that anybody that's ever had a warrant is a bad person, but you can't have warrants and also be the police.
It's a slippery slope.
You know, like, that's not, like, what are we doing?
Because there's a standard, and I think that's what we're getting away from.
It's the highest crime areas, like Detroit, behind St. Louis, is probably number two.
They're always top three.
So you take this person who's already not the most quality candidate.
Yeah.
And you put them, and some people will rise to the occasion for sure. And kudos to those people. But other people won't. And you're going to throw them into the most violent areas, paid the least amount of money, and expect them to do the same job. It's like, you're asking for tragedy. Yeah. Like you're asking for this to go horribly.
You would think their civil liability alone would cause them that they'd like, somebody with logic and who's reasonable would be like, guys, this is not a good idea.
Well, how do you testify?
Yeah. Yeah, what's the warrants for?
Yeah, how do you even testify?
Stealing?
Like, yeah, or like write a ticket. You know, like how do you write a ticket?
Yeah. Hypocrite. Don't get me started on hypocrites.
I couldn't believe it, man. When I seen it, I was like, how? How have we come to this? And I know how, obviously. You pay people less money. You make them out to be the bad guy in every situation.
Mm-hmm.
You treat them terribly.
Mm-hmm.
You ruin their lives when they have to use deadly force.
Yeah.
Whether their intentions were good or not. And that's how you end up with that candidate.
Yeah.
But it still doesn't. I don't know. Maybe I grew up in an era where like, the cops were expected to be something more than just a normal person, but right. You know, it just seems crazy.
No, I think that's logical. I think that's what we're missing in society is it's almost like the thing where if somebody whispers a lie to you for so long that you know it's a lie, eventually you're going to be like, oh, I can see that. I can, you know what, that actually sounds legitimate, right? It's what society is doing to us right now. There's all these extremes that's happening, and then we've heard about it for years now, and now it's like not so bad because we're used to it or numb to it.
Yeah,
and that's what's happening to the moral fabric, our true north as a country. In my opinion, is
deteriorating.
Yeah, for sure.
I don't know. It doesn't make any sense to me, man. It really doesn't. I don't know at what point we decided this was the correct path, but you know what I mean? It doesn't make any sense.
I truly think there's still a silent majority.
Sometimes. Yeah. I'm like, I just don't understand it. Yeah. It like makes no sense.
Which way is right? Which way is for sure.
Let's go back to you come back from your first deployment. You go to the police academy. How'd you do in the police academy?
Did good. I don't think anything stood out. Nothing crazy. I don't have any crazy memories. There was drama. Like I remember some drama that happened. But nothing worth bringing up. Yeah. So I applied to Jennings. And O'Fallon.
Buddy, you locked out.
So if people who are not familiar with this area listening, those are complete polar opposites.
Yeah.
Jennings is high crime.
It's also extraordinarily small.
Very, very small. It's probably got quadruple the amount of crime than O'Fallon does, and O'Fallon is 20 times bigger.
Yeah.
So I came to O'Fallon. And part of me was like, I want to be like Beninati or something like that. It was like, I want to work in North County. Or, you know, like I thought about applying to St. Louis City. And I've thought about applying to Las Vegas, like all these big cities. But I also wanted to start a family. You know, I have a reasonable head on my shoulders where I was like, you know what, that's not advantageous for a future family, right?
Yeah.
And being a 21-year-old at that time, 22 now that I graduated the police academy, am I going to get paid however many thousand dollars a year here or make $15,000 more there? Yeah. So I picked the higher paying job and, I've been there for 18 years. Jennings offered me a job after I had already accepted O'Fallon. So I don't know if that would have been different if I would have.
100% would have been different because they disbanded.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. That's why I ended up O'Fallon is because my in-laws lived in O'Fallon and that's where we stayed.
Was a completely different city when you first started too. 18 years ago was.
Yeah.
It was like the country.
It boomed like shortly before I got on. Is when it like really took off. It was one of the fastest growing cities for a while. And then, now it's, closing in on 100,000 people, which is, still a medium sized city, but it's big enough to where we're in the, I would say I can put a date on it, like 2012.
That's when I started.
I think 2012 is when O'Fallon started to get busier, at least in my personal recollection. A lot of things happened like.
That was the charter guy.
The charter guy.
That was your case, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah, that was a good case.
We'll get to it first, but you went through several more deployments before then, right?
One more. Yeah.
Okay.
So if you want to fast forward to the, I can finish up my military career. So my next deployment was dumb. I got deployed to Camp Buka, Iraq, which was strictly detainee operations. We worked 3 12-hour shifts in a row. We're off one day, worked 2 off one for a year. I felt like a loser. I felt like my God-given talents were not being utilized in a war-torn country. If being completely honest, like I just, that whole deployment was looking back on it, was a waste of time. Did I have just me being who I am? I had fun. Ran a half marathon and while getting combat pay, which I thought was funny.
Yeah.
Like,
were these detainees?
They were detainees. Yeah, we worked in a maximum security housing unit, which exposed the vast corruption of Iraq at the time. So we had guys that were sentenced by the Iraqi criminal court.
Iraqi criminal court.
Yeah, I forget the exact.
They're housed in a U.S. prison. Jail.
Yeah. So we actually trained, they called ICOs, the Iraqi correctional officers. We trained them. I beat every single one of them in ping pong. They're little wusses. You hear me? yeah. So we, these house, I forget the exact dimensions of the cells and ever, but there's one person per cell. They were in there for so many hours of the day. They came out for like an hour of rec, and that was it. Three meals a day, same meals every time. Every time they came out for the water closet. I just said that, and it brought back several memories.
Is that a shower?
I should probably not talk about. Anywho. So every time we brought them out, they're in belly chain, you know, blue box. And they would, you know, they'd make knives and stuff like that, and we do cell extractions, and not too many. It was very pretentious to be after Abu Ghraib. It was very, the colonel at the time was I believe it was the same battalion, but she was we called her Waffle Butt, because there were females. Believe it or not, this is breaking news. There's American females that would, I don't know if they had low self-esteem or something like that. They would put their butt against the chain link fence, and some of the detainees would come over and like rub on it and stuff. That's what we called them, waffle butts.
Really?
Yeah. I didn't personally see any waffle butts, but that's what we called this particular battalion commander, because she wanted to be loved by these guys, which is really weird.
Waffle butts. What the heck?
Like, you know, the chain link,
it makes sure sense. Yeah,
chain link fence. You put it, like, the next chain link fence you see, I want you to go up to it and be like, Katie, what's this look like? And she'll be like, it looks like a waffle. Waffle butt.
Huh. Very, I don't know.
Just informing,
I'm getting a mental picture.
Just informing Americans out there about the real story in Iraq.
Yeah.
Waffle butts. Yeah, so so that was it was very lovey-dovey, because anything happened to detainees after Abu Ghraib, like, it was a huge deal. Our chain of command to the president was like, we were told he got briefings on detainee operations a bunch. So anywho, we did that. We tore down camps. Here's what I was. We had steak and lobster every, was it Friday or Wednesday night?
Really?
World-class gym, giant gym.
Really?
It was, and the thing is, like, I severely enjoyed my first deployment over that one. It was like, it was the shared hardship type bonding. Yeah. You don't have any, yeah, you always want to bring stories or whatever or stuff like that, but there wasn't anything terribly difficult about it, yet people were more depressed. Because if you don't find stuff for soldiers to do, they're going to find stuff to do on their own, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's going to be nefarious, probably. There's prostitution going on. Like the intel people said, like if there was a female that had a cooler with a lid open outside of her trailer. One time that'd be open for business, or calf knee high socks or whatever. And I'm like, hey girl. Yeah, you know, it's just really? Like that was, yeah, the stuff that we're hearing. Like, so yeah, if you give some people free time, like, they're going to find it, especially in that type of environment. Yeah, it was a sucky deployment. Like, other than the half marathon, I got nothing to show for it.
Yeah. And that was a year?
That was a year, yeah.
And you had no kids still?
No, or? No. So Aubrey, my 15-year-old, she was four or five months old.
How hard was that?
Dude. Her?
Oh. Your poor wife, too.
That talking about, difficult. Like, that was the hardest thing, was leaving my kids, especially my baby girl. I remember we had a dedication for her at my mom and dad's house. Invited a bunch of close family and friends. And I sang a song to her. I couldn't even get through the song because I started crying. Like, oh. So that was like, that was probably the first time I think I've cried in front of people that I, you know, ever.
It's not that big of a deal. I do it all the time.
Yeah, but it was like, I couldn't get through the song. My sister sang, I believe she sang a song called How Beautiful, which is a beautiful song. How beautiful. Go figure, right?
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah, man. So that was super tough. So then it's about ready to get PG-13 in here. People, if you're listening, if you have kids younger than 13, make them close their ears up. So 4 hours before I left for Iraq, at least.
You conceived your second child?
Yes, in a casino hotel room in Bettendorf, Iowa.
No way.
Yeah. So the miracle behind that is we had to use a fertilization doctor. I don't know if that's what you call him.
Fertility.
Fertilization. That sounds better. Like my dad was a farmer, you know? So I fertilized my wife. So we had to use one of those for Aubrey. And there's some R-rated stories medically that they made me do that I won't want to repeat here.
They made you do?
Yeah, it involves a lobby bathroom.
DM has the best one of those stories.
It's very much like that one.
Really?
Yeah, oh yeah. So, yeah, I will not be sharing that today.
Well, after we're done.
Yeah, here. I'll let you know. Yeah, God bless that. Oh, screw it. So, yeah, I'll tell this one. That's fine. It's medical, right?
Yeah. Okay. I'm open to it.
This is going to get you some clicks, I think. Make sure you bookmark this.
This is going to be a reel on Instagram.
Yeah, for sure. So, Kristen's going to kill me. No, she's not. We're great communicators.
Yeah.
About to communicate. So, this is now a medical podcast, just so you know. So to try this thing, I think it's called IUI, where they take the male sperm and they spin it and get all the good swimmers and then take a turkey baster and inject it into the woman. So this particular clinic, I knew that that's what I was going to do when I went there, right? Doing a man's job.
How'd you prepare?
It's funny because I came, I believe I was after, it was after work or something like that. And they sit me in a regular exam room. They're like, and hand me a cup. That was it. They're like, all right, pretty boy, let's go. Here's your cup. They didn't say that, but that's how I remember it.
Is there a two-way mirror or a one-way mirror?
There might as well have been because the reason I say that, it was the closest exam room to like the desk. Like, no. The reception desk, where I heard my wife, like, talking about me, like, and having a conversation about us to the receptionist or nurse or whoever was out there. So I'm trying to do my manly deed and get my wife pregnant by myself. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So, sorry, honey. I shouldn't have said that. And then it worked out. We had Aubrey. So praise God.
So they... I don't get it.
Oh, we're going there.
I don't get it.
Yeah, you do.
I get it, but I don't get it.
What can you possibly not get from this?
Why would they do that to you? Why'd they leave you so close?
I don't know.
They could put you like three rooms back or something. No, give you some like
music. Something? Or something. Yeah, music would have been awesome. Yeah. I had the feel of my 38 and that was it.
Yeah. They should have played the same thing they do for CPR. It's like 100 beats per minute.
Yeah. All right, moving on. So
at this point, you were a policeman, right?
Yep, I was a policeman. So I say that it was a miracle because we didn't think we could get pregnant without help, right? And after the first successful pregnancy and birth, something fixed in my wife's body. So 4 hours before I left for Iraq, I impregnated my wife.
I'm guessing you found out while you were in Iraq?
Yeah, with Gunner.
That's cool.
I remember I was actually in Kuwait at the time, preparing to go.
Is it true that there's like ski lodges and stuff in Kuwait?
Ski lodges?
Like indoor skiing places?
I've never saw one, no. Yeah. I wish I would have done
that. Pretty fancy.
Oh, yeah. The cities in Kuwait are very fancy. Like, they're very nice. But we only got out once to go pick up our Humvees off the ship. That was it. But, so I was in the call center. They had this big trailer set up for a bunch of telephones. And I checked in with the lady to call home. And I remember just sitting there on the phone, and Kristen's like, "Guess what? I'm pregnant." I'm like, "No way." So I was like, "That's legit. That's awesome." So I told the call lady who's right there, I was like, "My wife's pregnant." And she's like, "Oh my gosh." So she was really happy too. I found out in Kuwait, and then she would keep me updated on all the stuff. But so now she has a 5-month-old and she's pregnant and I'm gone to Iraq.
Man.
And so she was in O'Fallon. She stopped working and just concentrated on herself, which I totally agree with, all the stress and everything like that. And then she went to go live with my parents while I was gone, and I'd get, at that time email was a lot better. Skype was a lot better. I don't know if anybody Skypes anymore, but we had Wi-Fi. It was invented.
Yeah.
Somewhere around that time, I don't know. Seems like so long ago. We had that. So I got to see little Aubrey grow up over the course of the next 8 months. And so my leadership arranged it so I'd be home on leave. So I was home on leave for 6 days before Gunnar was born.
Really?
And it was really neat. While I was home on leave, the pastor at our church in Springfield at the time did something for July 4th because he was born on June 26th. So we recorded something on the 27th, I think, because we were still in the hospital. He had somebody from every service that was a member of the church tell a story. And so I still have the recording. It's really neat. So he had somebody from World War II tell a story about being on a tow glider. Like, have you heard of those?
Yeah.
The gliders that other airplanes would tow, and they would freaking fly in on a glider with no engine.
Yeah.
How awesome is that?
Doesn't sound awesome
at
all.
During D-Day.
Sounds legit. Super scary.
And he's telling how he lost, he didn't know where people in his platoon were or whatever. Then he had somebody from the Korea War. Then he had somebody from Vietnam, my dad, and that was the most detailed story that I heard him tell. The same one that was Dick Thompson told, but Dick told it in way bit more detail.
Look it up, dude. I want to watch it now.
Yeah. Then it clipped to a guy in Desert Storm, and then it clipped to me, and everybody else's was in a atmosphere like this where they're being filmed under lights and camera, and mine was over Skype, and it made it look like I was in Iraq, but I was actually in the hotel room with Gunner.
No
way. So I was like, "Hey, I said, this is why we're doing this. This is why." But at that time, I believed in the cause.
What do you mean by that?
Let's move on. No, I'm just kidding. "Hey, this is, I had a little Gunner," and I went back. That was pretty rough going back after having Gunner.
Yeah, that had to be super hard.
I remember it was the night before I had to go to the airport. Chris and I didn't sleep. at all. And for one, it was the stress of me leaving again. And then two, Gunnar was just crying, and she actually like gently pushed him over to me. It says, take him with you. It's like, I can't put him in my rucksack.
Yeah.
I don't That's know. Funny. Yeah. So, yeah. So
how much longer did you have left in your deployment?
I think about 2.5 months.
Is that the deployment that you left and you tased yourself before you left?
Yes. Yeah. In roll call.
Yeah. I watched that video. It was pretty good.
Good times. You can link that too. So I got back, and actually while I was gone is when we can talk about this too, is when I put in for the candidate spot.
When you were gone?
Yeah.
How'd you do that? Did you send like an email back or something?
I did.
Really?
Yeah. They selected me for the candidate spot.
While you're in Iraq?
Mm-hmm.
No way. Yeah. I had no clue.
Yep.
So let's jump back to the beginning of your career in law enforcement. What was it? Like, you went through field training. What was that like?
Even though I went through like MP school and stuff like that, I still was very, very green, so to speak.
How old remember, were you, like 22?
22, yeah. I remember me confusing the phonemic alphabet with the military one constantly.
That would be super hard, yeah.
Because I was just fresh off a deployment and just 6 months of police academy. I would get so mad at myself for doing that. I don't remember. I know you asked this question in the past, like your first code run. Mm-hmm. I don't remember it. I had a not very amusing first arrest. But I remember putting handcuffs on him, be like, this is it. It's like, please resist. But he didn't.
Your first like couple months, was it everything that you thought it'd be? Like, so you wanted to be a cop forever.
Yeah.
Was it everything that you wanted it to be? And did it kind of feel it seems like some of you, like you have a little bit of animosity towards your deployments because you don't feel like you did exactly what you wanted to do.
Yeah.
Did it start to feel that like, okay, well, I'm doing what I want to do?
Yeah. Matter of fact, I felt like I was making more of a difference as a police officer than I ever did. Maybe not the first deployment. Definitely the second one, because like you're in the service industry, not hotel and restaurant, but you're there to serve people, mm-hmm. right? And I truly believe that. And I felt like I could make more of a difference on an individual basis as a police officer, talking to people, going on calls, being there for people, arresting bad guys, than I ever did.
Yeah.
Especially my second deployment.
That's the stuff that kind of gets overlooked. It's like for every hot call where we get to chase a car and find a bad guy, we've had 6 calls where you go and you talk to somebody that's in crisis, you talk to a family member that's just lost somebody that they love, or the person that just somehow got finagled into sending their life savings over
mm-hmm.
to Nigeria, or, you know, buys $30,000 with Apple gift cards and sends them somewhere.
Yeah.
Like that's the part that nobody really, it's like the unattractive part that's not on cops
mm-hmm.
you know, or on live PD. That like is the vast majority of the calls that we deal with.
Yeah. Actually, I remember I was in Kohl's a while ago and I saw an elderly lady on the phone with a scammer. Like I was listening. I was like, hang up the phone. She's like, what? I told her, I was like, I'm a police officer. They're scamming you. Hang up the phone. It's like little stuff like that. It's like,
oh, man.
And I just made a difference. And she was hook, line, and sinker.
Yeah. I've seen people hundreds of thousands of dollars, dude.
Yeah.
It's insane, but they do it, man.
Yeah. No, so yeah, that obviously gets overlooked a lot with, and it gets taken for granted too. I think something that I try to lead by example with, I fail at it numerous times, I'm sure, but just making sure that people feel like we're giving them a service.
Yeah.
You know, I know I've failed at it. I know for a fact I have.
Dude, that got instilled in me really, really early in my career. So I give a short story real quick. So I was still, I started in the jail. So I worked in the jail for like, I don't know, 6-7 months or something like that. And I was doing a ride along with Tony. We were like, he would just have me stop cars and write tickets for him. You know, because I was like, I wanted to be on the road so bad, dude. Right. And he'd be like, yeah, you can ride with me, just stop cars and, you know, write tickets and whatever else. Yeah. And I was like, dude, I'll do whatever. You know what I mean? And we're driving around on the north side of O'Fallon, and tone goes off. It's like suicide. Guy just shot himself. So, like, we're right down the street.
Yeah.
So, like, we turn the corner, and I'm driving, and I'm like, new, you know what I mean? Like, I'm like brand new.
Yeah.
So, you know, now I probably would have parked down the street. I would have approached from a distance, like all the things that you're supposed to do. Like, no, dude, I like put that Crown Vic in drive. I slammed on the gas and I pulled right up in front of the house. And this dude, he was 90 something years old. He had like really bad arthritis and like, I think it was osteoporosis.
I know exactly what color you're talking about.
Yeah.
This is across the street from my in-laws.
Seriously?
Yeah.
So, I didn't know that. So, they're like, this dude, long story short, the wife is like, he goes out and he gets the paper every single morning.
Yeah.
He slept in a little bit that day. So, she says he walks outside and he's like, she's like, hey, honey, I already got the paper. And the dude opens the door and says, I'm going outside to shoot myself. Mm-hmm. Walks out in the front yard, puts a revolver in his mouth, blows the whole top of his head off. And, like, I show up, dude, and I'm like, red line, dude. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm like, I'm trying to save this guy. Like, he's missing. His whole head's gone, dude. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, he could have done that at a hospital.
Yeah.
And it would have been over.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But I'm like, running up there. I'm like, put my gloves on. I'm about to start working on him. Like, I don't know. I just, like, again, young dude, got into law enforcement. I want to help this guy who just blew his head off. And obviously, the dude died. It was my first, like, real hot call.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, something happened while I was there. Like, showed up. I'm, like, overexposed. There's blood. There's brains everywhere. I'm stepping all of this guy's brains.
Yeah.
And they put me in that house with that lady for, like, 4 hours by myself. Nobody came in and checked on me. And, dude, I got on that lady's level. I felt like I was her best friend, dude. I was getting her sodies. I was going outside. I was getting her 7-Ups from the garage. Like, we sat, and I talked to this, like, 90-something-year-old lady for, like, 4 hours. And, like, she was sitting there just telling me all about this guy.
Yeah.
She's, like, crying. I'm, like, hugging her.
Yeah.
And, like, it taught me something, like, the very infancy of my career. I was, like, you can mean so much more than what you think you can mean to somebody. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, this lady just had the worst day of her life. She just watched her husband blow his head off in front of her. And, like, 2 hours later, I'm sitting there. And we're, like, talking about all these great experiences that they had together and the life that they lived together and the kids that they had and all the vacations that they traveled to and all this stuff, dude. And it was, like, that's stuck with me for a very, very, very long time.
Yeah.
But it was like, you know, Stringer. They're like, at one point, they're like, hey, should we go get him? He's like, nope, leave him in there to build character. And they left me in there for like 4 hours, dude.
It'll build character.
Yeah. Yeah. But it did. It really did, man. It was like, maybe probably not the best execution. But
Donna's a very nice lady.
You know her name?
Yeah. I know his name, too.
I can't even remember it.
Russ.
Was it? Yeah.
Yeah. That's funny. All the years we've known each other. And yeah, I know that guy for sure.
No way.
Numerous conversations with him.
He's like, I don't know, obviously didn't talk to him, but I talked to him. He seemed like a really like
super nice, good
guy. Yeah. Like absolutely. Really nice guy that just like got to the point where he's in so much pain. He was like, I'm done, man. I can't keep doing this.
Yeah.
Oh, sad, dude.
Very sad.
That old lady was so sweet, man.
She is.
She likes 7-Up too.
I didn't know that about her.
Yeah, we were drinking sodies together, dude. I'm serious, man. I was like, I was so like new.
Yeah.
And so, it was so much to me. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, that was my first time ever seeing a dead person.
Yeah.
Ever seeing a brain. Ever seeing somebody shoot themselves. You know, like, all of the things.
Right.
And obviously, she was like traumatized by what just happened. It was like, like, we were able to get on each other's level. It was like I was a 21-year-old kid,
mm-hmm.
and she's like an I think she was slightly younger than him.
Yeah.
I think she was like late 80s, maybe early 90s. Cause I think he was like 93 or 96 or something like that.
Yeah.
But like completely different worldly exposures. You know what I mean? Like she's,
it just comes to the point, like the communication again, there you go. There you have it. Is because you were able to get on her level. She trusted you. And that's a gift that not everybody has. That can do that. That can communicate with all different walks of life. Because you can't talk to her the same way you talk to Reggie down the street,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But in their time of need and grief, you got to find somewhere to connect. And 9 times out of 10, like, those are the calls that mean more to that person at that particular time than we can ever know, right?
Yeah, it meant a lot to me too, man, as like a brand new policeman. You know what I mean? Like having that conversation with that lady. Like, no, it sounds ridiculous, but it meant a lot that like she was willing to talk to me. Because sometimes you go to like some of those calls and the people are angry and they mm-hmm. like want to punch you in the face. Like you have done nothing. Mm-hmm. Like you didn't do anything.
It's a very awkward thing that we do.
Yeah.
Is a lot of people don't understand that we'd have to be in your house until we get basically clearance from the medical examiner or suspicious or something like that, right?
Yeah.
But we go into somebody's house we've never met before on the worst day of their life and watch them as they call family members or I said, do you want me to call? Because I know they're just hysterical. And they're like, yes, mm-hmm. please. And then you call them and you tell people information that's going to be the worst day of their life.
Yeah.
And so that our job is, yeah, yeah. There's also circumstances where we need to be on our game too. Be like, hey, something doesn't smell right. The sniff mm-hmm. test, you know, like something doesn't seem right. So, you know, we can still be compassionate and everything like that. But still, like, if it's an obvious something like that, what you had,
yeah,
that's one of those feelings that this is a weird to say, but I'm glad that you were there in that moment.
I am too. I think it taught me so much about how to be a policeman.
Yeah.
You know, like,
darn you, Stringer.
Yeah, dude, that lady's like hurt. She's ingrained in my mind forever. If I get Alzheimer's when I'm, you know, 80 years old or at this rate, probably like 50, but
yeah,
I will remember that lady forever. You know what I mean? Like yeah, yeah. I will remember that conversation. I'll remember that lady forever. That was like my introduction to law enforcement, like my first big thing that I go to. And I'm like, just
yeah,
have no clue.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
and it's, I'm jumping way ahead cause I know we'll get to it, but it was validated whenever I had my incident with my house. I received dozens of letters from people that I've dealt with that I forgot about.
Really?
From over my career. With notes, with cash.
No way.
Yeah. And just because it's the way I treated them at that particular moment, whether it was a criminal call or, you know, or just a normal call. Like, I remember you from this call. You were overly nice or fair. You helped me out on the worst day of my life, for lack of a better terms. So it just validated everything that I've done, the way I treated people, the way that you want to be treated.
Yeah. It's insane, dude.
Yeah.
Yeah. That story is nuts. We'll have to get to that in a minute. So you come back from that deployment. It was relatively.
Yeah.
You were ready to come back.
I was ready to come back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what was were your goals always in law enforcement to handle a dog? Is that your like,
I mean, always, I think so. The big influence in my life at that point, like my big brother at the police department, was Bob Schoonover.
Yeah, solid dude.
Yeah, and he had a dog, Dar, and we lived very close to each other at the time, and so whenever I didn't have kids, well, like now I think about like what did I do before I had kids?
Yeah,
and it's like, oh my gosh, how much time did I waste before I had kids? Because before I had kids, and even after, I think, I would run tracks for his dog, Dar. And I laid 100 tracks for him. if not more. He owned a gym at the time in Troy. I would go to the gym with him. Like, Bob and I were like buddies, you know, like.
He's a cool dude.
I did. Yeah, he is. I did everything with him. So that's why I fell in love with dogs, is because Dar was an amazing dog. Bob tells a story, his favorite track that he ever did with Dar was, I don't want to script the mileage or anything like that, but it was of a suicidal juvenile that took pills and took off walking. And Dar knew, and you can test this too, like, he knew there was something different about this track. He pulled harder. He said he pulled harder than ever before. Like,
you got to be careful. You end up with stuff stuck in your face. Your dog pulls too hard. Right. End up with a tree in your
right
mouth.
But, you know, like, whenever you're closer to somebody, your dog knows.
Yeah.
And there's a different scent than somebody who's running from the cops and then somebody who's scared.
Yeah, you get, like, fear pheromones. And
yeah. So the dogs can smell that because they're a million times better than we are. So I helped him a lot with Dar, and I was good friends with Joe Litzinger at the time, who had Rocky. So I interviewed for the, well, I sent the email of interest first from Iraq, and they pretty much said, yeah, go ahead. So I get back from Iraq in October, and I think it was March or something like that. February, March. I had a dog named Saber. We went to school in Indiana, and me being a jovial guy that I am, sometimes people get rubbed the wrong way, maybe. One of my faults maybe is I am not serious all the time. Maybe I joke around a little bit in the wrong moments. And sometimes that's just my way of dealing with stress, whether I know it's stressful or not. And like I said earlier, like, I don't like it when people are uncomfortable around me. So I think, well, maybe cracking a joke here is a lot of the times it's not a good idea. So, I mean, I probably joked around a little too much and said some things that, comparatively speaking, and I'll go to my grave with this, were not as bad as other stuff that was going on. But, so I was asked to go home 3 weeks into the course, the 5-week course.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Dog was locked on, too. He's a good dog.
Whatever happened to him?
He was given to another guy in the class who had a crappy dog.
Really?
Yeah. And, yeah, so I don't know what happened to him after that, his career or anything like that. Hmm. It was a great, beautiful dog.
It was a shepherd?
Yeah, big. The big old boy. So what I wrote a 12-page memo to the chief, and I had Bob read it over. He added some things, or suggested that he didn't add anything. He suggested some things, and basically it was admitting to everything that they said I said. Like, you know, it wasn't anything crazy. It was some probably inappropriate things, but it wasn't, like, stuff that you don't hear every day.
Yeah.
You know? So that was a humbling experience. There's no point of being bitter about the situation. I think the leadership at the time could have stood up for me a little bit more. But I'm not placing blame on anybody but myself. Had I not said anything, my life would have been maybe a smidge different, you know? But Lord has other plans. That was my
I think I had just career. Started or was about to start right as all that was going down. Because I think that led to another guy getting a dog, and then that guy not, and him not keeping that dog on the road, and then they go into another guy, and then that dog was blind, and then led to a lot of, like,
yeah,
disastrous stuff. And I think I had just started at the beginning of all that, which is right around that charter situation.
Yeah,
I think is probably one of the craziest calls I've ever heard of.
Yeah.
You want
to debrief that thing? I can go into that real fast.
What's up, guys? Thanks for hanging in there for this week's episode. As you can tell, there's more from this guest. And here's a sneak peek from next week's episode.
Go up the stairs and It's the apartment on the right, first one on the right. And by this time, Derek's caught up to me and knock on the door, hear dogs bark. And then jokingly, we make a comment about, I wish we had body cameras back then, but make a comment about the dog poop on the deck, you know, the right outside the door. We're like, oh, look at that poop. And then knock on the door again and say, police department, you know, kind of hostile. Just once again, just being jovial.
Really?
And then heard a thud. I'm like, do you hear that? He goes, yeah. Then I knock again real fast, say, police department. And then I hear, help me, from a female voice, obviously. And I look at him. He looks at me. I turn around to donkey kick it because you limit injury that way, you know, and it's supposed to be stronger kick. And you can, tactically speaking, you're kind of covering half your body already, right? So instead of just kicking it front ways. So I donkey kick it and then turn around, guns out. And in the first room on the right is a bedroom, right? And then in this apartment, the kitchen's on the left, the living room is straight ahead. So about 15 feet away, I see a young female with a blindfold and one of those sex ball gags, like hanging down a little bit. She was handcuffed behind her back with rope tied around her ankles, back to her neck. Like, so she's hogtied,
yeah,
basically.
So if she kicked, it would choke herself.
Yes. So if she kicked, choke herself. Derek and I stepped over her to clear the back rooms real fast. Number one is you got to get rid of the threat, right? Nobody's in the apartment. The thud we hear was him jumping off the balcony.
The 1078 Project podcast is proudly sponsored by Deemed Fit. Deemed Fit is an activewear and a leisure company created for first responders. Be a part of their movement to instill confidence, motivation, and a willingness to keep pushing forward. Deemed Fit is a first responder-owned company looking to help first responders and their friends stay as physically and mentally fit as possible. Stay Deemed Fit.